Right, hello and welcome everyone. Welcome to yet another episode of Contact Lost, the Polish English speaking podcast about competitive Warhammer 40K. Wow, we've been releasing a lot of those episodes right now, but I think it's always the case before a major event. So we did that before the WTC. We went there, so we felt obliged to do a lot of episodes about that. And now we're going to the LGT to do live coverage of that as well. And we also feel obliged to deliver as much content as possible before the event. So you could have seen episodes with Kyle Grundy, with Will Whitaker, with James Grover, and many, many others, people who will participate at the event, both in the Invitational and the main event. And yeah, we just felt that it's right to put some spotlight onto them and allow them to talk and bring their top seven something to you for your viewing pleasure. Today is not going to be very different. So today you can see the guest on the screen already. So I have decided to bring in Ines Wilson, known from StatCheck, known from the Scottish national team, and probably many other things that I cannot remember right now. So welcome, Ines.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure. I will say, your intro music, very different vibe to ours, but also a bop. I was just dancing along the entire way through the 30 seconds. Can't help it.
So the feeling is mutual because I, like last week or 2 weeks ago, I wrote to Jeremy to ask whether the music for your show is actually like a tune that someone from StatCheck has created, or is it from the internet? Because it's just such an earworm. And when I walk my dogs, I listen to it and then I hum it throughout the entire day. So I mean, yeah, the podcast music is better than we thought. Anyway, today we focus on you, and today we focus on your top seven, or the top seven of your choosing, which is the top seven force multipliers going into the LGT, or in general, top seven force multipliers in the game right now. But before we get into that, maybe let's focus on you first and on what you do, and then maybe a little bit on the LGT. But yeah, let's start about you. We had you previously on the show at the time when the game was sort of in a hiatus, when we were in between 9th and 10th, and yep, podcasts didn't really have a lot to cover because people already didn't want to play events waiting for the 10th edition and so on. So we did the series about my 40k job, and you came and talked about what you do professionally now. So yeah, let's delve into that a little bit. How is that going? Would you like to recommend that to anyone, perhaps?
I mean, personally, obviously I have to, right?
Obviously.
So yeah, no, I've been doing the sort of the coaching side of things full time now since the start of February, which is when I got back from LVO. It's now September. So frankly, the fact that it's still going is confusing, and I'm eternally grateful for it. It's been an awesome 6 or 7 months now. Wow, that's way too long. I'm definitely turned soft and feeble in my work from home life. I don't think I'm capable of working like 3 hours in a row now. But other than that, no, it's been going really well. Been picking up steadily with more people coming on board, as partly I do better at tournaments, and partly, well, and also like play things like Death Guard, which apparently there was a big group that were like, wow, people are playing factions. It's not normal faction. that helped a ton as well. So there's always like good ways to like market yourself and get publicity out. And that combined with, I think generally the growing tournament scene, like people, it died down a little bit across sort of like the really, really terrible meta, but it was still growing a little bit. And it definitely seems like it's back to being fairly reasonable growth again. So that combined with the two and me just being a little more, you know, out there, people knowing what I do a little more has helped it grow steadily, which has been great. I'm to the point where I like have to actually schedule my week now, as opposed to just being like, yeah, so you can go in on Monday at this time and you can go in on Monday at this. Like, and I'm now at the point where like I have to actually like pay attention so that I don't overload a day or anything like that, which is a good kind of problem to have, but not one that I was anticipating having. So it's something that I'm like working through, is like actually scheduling for myself, which it turns out I'm not great at. So
so would you say that the growing popularity of the game and the events, it's going to be probably a weird question, but do you think that this can be attributed to GW actually doing a good job with 10th edition? Or is it thanks to people like you, thanks to people like, I don't know, whoever does podcasts right now, Adam Camilleri, or, you know, other people who draw audiences to YouTube, to Spotify, to other places like that, who actually, you know, make people want to play the game? Which one is it?
I think it's a bit of both. So when the game is at least palatable, Games Workshop set the minimum bar for how many people are going to be invested. The community encourages people to do more of that, right? That's kind of the, like, Yeah, Games Workshop set the quantity, and then the tournament scene and the people involved in it and the community and all that set the quality, not the quality, like in the way that people approach it. So people still played 40k during the break. They just play games with their friends in their house. They didn't go to tournaments because there was no point, right? You know, the amount of people that are doing that is going to be determined by how good the game is. If there are more tournaments, there's more opportunities, right? That's great. But those have to exist, and people will have to want to go to those for other reasons. So I don't think either of them get to the state without the other. Games Workshop has done a really good job of taking the community feedback on board and doing their best to change the mark in terms of how the game is balanced. Did they get it perfect? No, they're never going to get it perfect. It's unreasonable to expect them to. They did a good job, and I think the numbers of recovery show for it. I think very briefly, like we saw the stats for this weekend, there was 2,000 players at the tournaments this weekend, which is like double what it was the weekend before. Like, yeah, part of that is it's now September, it's no longer the summer holidays. People maybe don't have their kids as much, so they can, you know, like go to a tournament, or, you know, teachers, and like, you know, there's a billion reasons why there could be a bigger why, but
obviously.
But it's good to see that, like, we can get back to those numbers again. LGT last year was the busiest weekend we had on record. So I look forward to seeing how it does, you know, similar, like, even compared to, like, LVO. Like, the actual weekend as a whole was more games. And if this year shows that it's similar numbers or more numbers, well, that shows good year-on-year growth, right? That's kind of what you're looking for. But
yeah. I was quite surprised when I saw the numbers for the Polish team championships that took place last week, I mean the weekend before this one. So we had almost 250 players, I think 45, 46 teams, five-man teams that went there and played, which is unprecedented for Poland. Like, we've never heard
twice the size of the previous biggest Polish event or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. So, and you know, and this attracted sponsors that we usually wouldn't see, because there was like a dairy company that actually provided food. There was another company that never had anything, I think like a patisserie that would never have anything to do with the event, but Poland winning the WTC plus just the organizers doing a good job attracted more people, more sponsors, more everything. I guess it's testament to the fact that the game is in a good place.
Yeah. I would also like to say that I think that a general changing attitudes towards team events has come about a little bit. The amount of extra coverage towards it, like, not this is probably less effective for Europe, but towards, like, I know the American team has announced a bunch of team tournament format, like a couple of like team tournament circuits and stuff like that. And the UK has like the ITT and and the one that's not the ITT, but it's basically the ITT. Coventry teams, I think it's like the Coventry ITT. I don't know. It's difficult to keep track of these things that are, like, you know, sell out almost instantly. We've hit capacity for our team event in Scotland, which is significantly smaller, but it's like, you know, getting 12 teams of five in Scotland is unheard of. We had 60 tournament players 5 years ago. So it's really awesome. Like, I genuinely, like, the team community has been incredibly welcoming to all the new people that come on board. I know, just paying attention to, like, the WC captains chat, which is like there's just new people, like, drip feeding into it every couple of weeks, like new captains, new teams, new countries all together. And it's incredible. Like, it's genuinely awesome. And as everybody knows, as we team evangelists say, it's the best way to play 40k, right? So
yeah,
which nobody believes until they do it.
So many people have said that already, that, you know, as long as they keep on repeating it, it will eventually become the truth. But I think there is also, like, a lot to back this up in terms of facts. Like, if you look at the WTC, that's a place you want to be. It's the Olympic Games of this game. And then the fact that it is sort of driving multiple nations or shaping what the nations do. Like, if you look at France, if you look at Poland, if you look more and more nations that actually adjust their circuits to prepare for the WTC, it's a fantastic thing.
Yeah, exactly. Even America and Canada, bastions of doing things their own way, are, like, changing the way they do their qualification processes and all that sort of thing. And it's really great. I know, for one thing, like, there's a Team China trying to come next year.
Wow.
It's going to be awesome.
I heard of Korea, but not of China. But then, yeah. And that would be something, that those would be probably, like, the dark horses of the event, because no one knows what they do. Exactly. I think I've seen one episode of the Thursday show by Adam Camilleri and Dustin from Team Canada, who once talked about a tournament in Singapore, and, like, their wacky lists and so on, but that was the only time I heard about the game in Asia. So that would be mind-blowing.
There used to be a really good podcast that kind of covered that sort of scene. Like, it was centered around like a guy in China, a guy in a couple of guys in Australia, and another guy in New Zealand. And it was called 40K Frontiers, and they did like, they covered like a tournament in Argentina and Mexico and all that, and like the Singapore and China and Japan and all that stuff. And sadly, that podcast went away, but it was run by a couple of friends of mine, so I'm going to shout it out for having been a good show at the time. But yeah, there's definitely a gap for like that kind of content coming out again, because there's so many people playing games in all kinds of places. You see it occasionally just like pop up on like the Meta Mondays or on the like Good Number Competitive Innovations of like tournaments in Mexico with like a slightly weird meta and like, they're not big tournaments, right? They're not by our standards, but they're big tournaments. Like there are, you know, 30 to 60 people playing games in these little countries that nobody would expect. Team Argentina have been to WTC before. Like, yeah, I don't know. I think there's a ton of space for really cool innovations that outside of this traditional sort of like 40K centers that everybody hears and speaks about.
Absolutely. Yeah, agreed. Definitely a niche that needs to be filled in. So if anyone is listening and you have an idea and some spare time on your hands, we cannot cover everything, so go ahead and try, and we will welcome you with open hands, because the more content creators, the more good content out there, the better for everyone. All right, Innes, let's move on to your topic of your choosing. So the top 7 force multipliers at the LGT. The LGT, like the WTC, is happening very shortly after a major change to the meta. So either the release of the 10th edition before the WTC, or now the release of the balanced data slate. What would you describe the state of the game going into the LGT before we get to those
forces? Am I allowed to be mean here?
Honest.
Okay. It's still miserable in like, it's miserable against one faction. And then other than that, it's great. But that faction still exists, so I can't like, with any credence, say that this is a fun meta. Mm-hmm. I fundamentally do not think there is a point playing a game against a good Eldar player. You just show up and you lose. There is scope for them to make a mistake. There is scope for you to be better than them. There is no scope if you are both good and you both play reasonably without committing mistakes. You lose that game. It does not matter really what you do. And I do not find that particularly enjoyable as somebody who wants to try and trade on how good I am at the game. Feeling like that doesn't really matter that much in the tough games is, you know, disheartening, to say the least.
Unless you bring Eldar yourself and you play Eldar versus Eldar, which turns it into almost like a game of chess then.
Also, I'm not an Eldar player, and I do not have the years of experience and muscle memory on that kind of faction, and I don't own that faction, so I'm not doing that. But yeah, whether I own the army or not, I generally prefer not to be a determining factor in how well you do at a tournament. I get that there's always like a, you know, you always want to have a spread, like a range of armies you're okay playing, and one of them should be like top 5-ish, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. But when, you know, you're playing Army 2 and you feel like you can't beat Army 1, it's not a very diverse meta.
Mm-hmm. So going into the LGT very soon after the balanced data slate, do you feel well prepared, and do you feel that you have playtested what you want?
Oh, I feel incredibly enough. Well prepared to lose to Eldar, yeah.
To lose to Eldar.
I don't know, man. I spent a bunch of time playtesting armies for LGT, so I, obviously the new Tyranny Codex came out, and I put a few games into that. I put a bunch of games into Grey Knights, because all of the buzz coming out of, like, Team America after WTC was that, you know, the Eldar matchup is great for... It's not. It's terrible. It was awful. when you play it into, like, you know, somebody... Well, I have the matchup with someone like Brian Sipe as a practice partner, so I put that game to Brian. It's miserable. I put them in the box. Or I play them into 20 Necron Warriors, and the end net result of the game is that I killed 2 models. You know, things like that were very disheartening for the Grey Knight build. I then put some time back in on my Dark Angels, which I'm playing for the Invitational, and I could not find a Dark Angels build that I liked for the other matchup, which I knew, like, my WTC list, the line I had was it lost to a Night Spinner and the Incarn, and neither of those units went away, so I don't know why I thought them losing points would change anything there. I would lose to a particularly comfortable 500 points of Eldar with that army, with the Night Spinner and the Incarnate, maybe like a Warp Spider squad. I think I lose that game as Dark Angels, so that kind of felt pointless. I played that game, I got tabled on turn 2 and moved on with my life. So I ended up like putting a few practice games in on CSM, because I was recommended them by a few people. Anthony being an evangelist for CSM, Brian quite liking them, having played against them a bunch. So I put some games into that, found that I kind of liked the style, felt like I had it's one of those armies that it feels like you kind of always have a puncher's chance because everything does so much effing damage that you can just be like, right, let's just try this. And if it works, then at least I have the high roll potential. And that was what I kind of felt like I was missing into some of, into like Eldar, was just the ability to just be like, hey, what if I just scam you? What if I just put the Chaos Lord in and he hits 11 times and Dev wounds 7 times and picks up a Wraith Guard squad? Like, I can work with that. It's not likely, but I can work with that. Whereas my Deathwing Knights weren't making combat. So so that's kind of the direction I went. Obviously, we'd seen a bunch of people like Alex Sacco and Liam Viesel play them to a great extent as well. Fantastic players that are definitely leading the way on stuff like that. So I ended up with a build very similar to theirs. I'm quite excited. I'm quite excited to play it. I feel fairly prepared. I've not prepped as much as I would like. But I also feel a lot more comfortable in the list. Like last year, I had a pretty bad run with Gene Circults where I was just underprepped. I swapped to the list, didn't get enough practice on it, played it at a tournament, had okay results, took it to LGT, had not great results because I hadn't really tested the Necro matchup enough, lost them twice, and then kind of stuck with them, which I was kind of happy with, like, because I then ended up pulling them into like some decent runs after that. But the LGT itself was rough. Whereas for CSM, the playstyle feels pretty familiar, pretty similar. It's not like a wholesale, like I'm not playing a Horde army with like control elements for the first time. I'm playing a high damage melee army. I've played that before with like good shooting elements. It feels very like my Iron Hands is really what I'm getting at.
I wanted to say.
It feels a lot like Iron Hands and I'm very comfortable with Iron Hands.
And so, it's not going to break your back as well, like playing it while, you know, playing Jinx to a cult or any other Horde army.
Wasn't that bad either. But yeah, you're not wrong. It's like 40 models. It's great.
I mean, I you know, any kind of that army. I remember being there at the LGT last year and seeing Manny with his little cart with all the racks. Like, he looked like an old man just bent over this cart, pushing it from table to table.
Manny and Manny's invitational list, right?
I've seen Manny's invitational list. I've played against that list even. So yeah, I know what he's bringing, but it's still not as many as his rack list.
I'm not sure it isn't, to be fair. It's like,
maybe it's getting close, but I think the racks was still like more
sure. Units. I think his invitational list is only like 180 models. It's not far off. I feel like if you're within like plus or minus 10% of 200 models, like you're allowed to just be like, this is too many models.
By the way, are all the lists available now? So
I have no idea if the main event lists are available right now. I have not even remotely checked. I know that the invitational lists are because they've been available for 2 weeks.
Yeah, so that I have seen. I was surprised because Zach told us, I think, to post the lists by the 13th of September, not to get enough practice with them. But then I didn't even know when they became available. But anyway, we're digressing. Let's get down to the top 7 force multipliers, because I think the majority of those units, if not all, will be seen at the LGT.
I wouldn't be surprised if every single one of these data sheets made top 8. So
yeah. So let's start.
Sure. Should I start by telling people why I'm defining a force multiplier as? It's probably the best.
Yes, I think that's the best sort of introduction before we go into it.
Cool. So my basic premise with this was force multipliers are units that make an army do more than it should, right? So it's whether it's a unit that gives you like a new option, a new dimension of play, a unit that takes a build and turbocharges it and makes it like actually a viable list at the top level, or just a unit that allows like everything else to just function easier. They're not necessarily like the high damage units. They're not necessarily like the anchor units that you're going to build your list around. You know, like a high damage unit might be something like Desolation Marines or Deathwing Knights from my previous list, or, you know, like an anchor unit that you build around being like the Abaddon and Terminators, you know, just a thing that you have that's solid and sits in a place. The force multiplier is often like, it's a small, it's a single piece. It, you know, they can be expensive. They can be inexpensive. You know, like Gulliman from last edition was a great example, or even this edition is a great example of a force multiplier. It's something that takes everything else and says, hey, go do more than you should. And there's a lot of different ways you can approach that, and we'll touch on some, and I hope to touch on some of those during the like the top 7, plus the bonus mention of the model I hate the most in Warhammer. So yeah, that's kind of the thought process behind it, was these are units that by virtue of them existing allow a build to exist that doesn't exist otherwise, or allow a build that is good to function at like peak efficiency. That's kind of the thought process behind it. The idea being that if you took this unit out, the list is less than the sum of its parts. Whereas with this unit, everything just cleans up, becomes a tournament list rather than a list that you were playing, is kind of the thought process.
Yeah, and I really appreciate it as well, because this is one of the topics that I find the most interesting. And also, probably, not everyone is as seasoned with the game as you, for example. So there is still a lot of educational value for people to watch this and take something away from this. So
without further ado, you can hear my opinion on a bunch of factors I really don't like. So
I mean, it's always of value. So let's jump right into it. I'm just gonna share my screen so that everyone can see what we are talking about. I think the presentation. Yeah, okay, it's there. Let's go with your number 7, because I understand we have them in ascending order. So,
yep. So my number 7 is the Necron Canoptic Reanimator. The idea being that this is, it's a model that provides, so for anybody who doesn't know what it does, it provides a 12-inch aura of whatever a unit would reanimate. It reanimates an additional D3 wounds. So when you have units like Necron Warriors that can reanimate like 75 billion times a battle round, slight exaggeration, I think it's like 8. That's a lot of additional healing. It really helps those units hit the threshold where they become actually unkillable for a majority of armies. The idea being something like, you can have a Canoptic Reanimator, you take damage, you use the stratagem that when you take damage, you reanimate, and your Necron Warrior unit reanimates 2d3 plus 4 damage. And then you get shot again, and then you use the Ghost Arc. And then in your opponent's command phase, you heal an additional again. And then in their command phase, you heal additional. And between the time of you getting shot, the first time you got shot, the second time you got shot, the Reanimator's brought like 8 extra models back. And it really helps for push through that critical mass. Because it's an aura as well, it supports 2 units at once. It can support Lich Guard. It supports character healing. Things like the Doomsday Arc, the Transcendent Catan. Just everything just stays a little bit more topped up because of the Reanimator. And yes, it's not cheap. Yes, it's not fragile, but you can't stand it in the open kind of thing. Like, it's not fragile when it's behind a wall. It does lock your army down a little bit, which is why I have it at number 7, because it definitely limits a little bit of the way you approach the game, and it's not an essential unit, but for the way that, like, the Necron Horde, or, like, Horde plus Lich Guard, whether it's, like, 20 Warriors, 10 Lich Guard, double Lich Guard, or double Warriors, maybe even triple Warriors if you're an absolute psychopath, the Canoptic Reanimator really just cleans up that game plan. It makes everything just flow a little simpler. It gives your opponent like a solid point of attack. Like, you can say, hey, if you want to try and sink like 2 Night Spinners, 3 Night Spinners into this, yeah, maybe it goes down. But that's a turn you didn't Night Spinner anything else. So, you know, in that way as well, it helps out a ton. I would struggle to justify putting a building a Necron list that didn't center around one of these, as far as it being like the thing that just makes sure everything else works. And you could always just leave the range of it, right? It's not like it's essential. But for 100 points, it's, or 100 points or that ballpark, I've genuinely no idea what this costs. Necron lists are impossible to read because every single unit blends together. Canoptic. Yeah, 105 points. It does exactly what you're looking for from a unit that's kind of like this thing. It's also just like OC3 and with a 4-up field of pain on your home objective, not going to randomly die. It can, you know, make itself an assault weapon with the stratagem to advance and shoot and grab your investigative signals or whatever, or get on a midfield objective. Like, it does everything you're looking for out of a little garbage unit, which is to say it makes your army impossible to kill and scores points, which for 105 points, I'm not really complaining. You can't really complain about.
Yep. So a question, again, because this is supposed to be both fun and enjoyable, but also educational. So let's pretend for a moment that your first game, you face a Necron army with that unit on the table. What would your target priority in such a game be? Would you go for the force multiplier to eliminate it immediately if your opponent allows you to, and then bit by bit focus on the hammers of the list, so either Warriors, Lich Guard, or Locust Destroyers? Or would you focus on the hammers and, you know, completely ignore the force multipliers, because as long as there are no hammers, the force multiplier is not important anyway?
Yeah, so my advice to Necrons is to know your damage output. If your list can kill a Necron Warrior Brick, just kill the Warrior Bricks. If your list can't kill the Warrior Bricks, kill everything else and get to the objectives first. Those are your two options. There is not really a third. You cannot chip damage a Warrior Squad. You cannot really chip damage a Lich Guard Squad. You can Lich Guard are a little easier because they have a little bit less access to reanimation and they heal a little bit less, like they don't get the plus 3. So you can maybe try and force some damage to them if you have the right profiles. But broadly, no, don't bother. If you can kill, if they've got the Catan, if they've got Doomsday Arcs, if they've got Destroyers, focus them, just get rid of them. If you can't kill a Warrior Brick, don't try. You killing the Reanimator is not going to make a difference. The Reanimator is there to create a you must be this tall to ride, the killing Necron Warriors party bus. You know, if you can't kill 20 Necron Warriors in one activation, you can't kill 20 Necron Warriors at all. It's not possible. They heal too many times. Unless you have, like, 5 units that will all kill 10, then you can maybe like get like 4 damage to stick to them a turn. On turn 5, you can kill that squad. it's not valuable. It doesn't do anything for you. So just don't bother trying. Whereas, you know, if your opponent gives you the ground rare, like if they let you drop in and obliterate it to death, or you shoot it with, you're running triple whirlwind and you oath it turn one and kill it, like, sure, like, fine. If it's sat behind a wall, you're not interacting with it. You know, maybe you can get six inceptors onto it or something like that. But if they give you it, take it out, because then you can start actually damaging Necro Warriors. But if they don't, they're not going to give it to you. So just go around it, either go through the warriors or go around it and get to everything else and get to the objectives first. That's really the way to approach it. It's a false multiplier in the sense that it just says, it creates this like gate check where you must pass, you must pass a certain damage threshold to interact with Necron Warriors or to interact with Lich Guard. And you spending a bunch of those resources trying to kill a reanimator that has a functional 12 wounds and a 3-up save behind a wall is just, you know, it's a little bit pointless.
Yeah. Okay. That is clear. Let's move on then.
That sounds good.
Number six.
Back to the second one. So the second number six is not technically a unit, although we have provided the carrier for it. It's the World Eater's Enhancement Favored of Khorne, which is generally I would recommend running on a Juggernaut and Lord on Juggernaut, or potentially a Master Accused if you're really trying to save points. Mm-hmm. All this does is when you do your Blessings of Khorne roll, which is the eight dice you roll looking for doubles and triples and sixes and twelves and, you know, like the left color, the left pit pointing to the east and the right pit pointing to the north and all that kind of stuff. You just get to reroll that. But it's not technically a reroll, which means if you've used icons, which are the things that sit in like Jackal squads and Berserker squads that say if you're on an objective, reroll a dice, you get to use those rerolls on the initial roll and then also on the second attempt. So it gives you a lot of chances, a lot of attempts for hitting Anger on Resurrection, for hitting Advance and Charge, plus two move. Lethal hits if you want it, Fight on Death being a very big one in a lot of the meta right now because there's a ton of melee armies out there again, which is great to see. Favorite of Khorne just cleans up all of that. And when you're playing an army that is as volatile as World Eaters, which I think are generally a bit sleeper for the meta, like Anthony Vanilla has played them for the main event, so is Michael Hooper from Team Iceland, or a few other people like that. They're a super, super dynamic army that has a really, really awkward fail point in the Blood Yahtzee, the Favors of Khorne. Yeah. And this just makes that work on a very, very much more consistent level where it becomes a thing you can actually rely on. It changes the math, like, you know, it takes you from like 80% to hit like the plus two move advance and charge to, you know, much, much higher, like in the 90s. And that is the kind of thing that over the course of a 5 to 10 round tournament wins games. Without him, you can play the army. The army is good. The army is not great. With this, it is reliable. It does exactly what it says on the tin. You get all of your mechanics in. And then you also get, like, with the Juggernaut Lord, you get like a backfield objective holder that does some mortal wounds on the charge, is reasonably tanky. With the Maximum Executions, you get like a secondary damage output source, but the guy wants to sit at the back because once this guy goes down, it tends to be a little awkward. One thing you'll find a lot from these first multipliers is there are units that like to sit at the back quite a lot, because if you're not multiplying your force anymore, well, then what's the point of having them?
Exactly.
But he's definitely like just a nice little piece that sits at the back. I know he's in Anthony's list at the very least. I've not had a chance to see like the Icelandic version. But yeah, just makes the game plan simple. You do what it says on the tin almost every turn. And when you're playing an army, it's really, really, really wants to get in your opponent's face because it doesn't really do anything else. It's nice to have that kind of reliability and surety that your plan is going to work, especially given that you roll Blood Tithe at the beginning of the battle round, not at the start of your turn. So if you go second, your opponent knows what you have. And, you know, there are advantages and disadvantages to that. But if your opponent knows you don't have advance and charge this turn, well, you're going to probably have a bad turn as everything sits at just that dart engine says, like, sticks its nose at you and goes like, neener, neener, neener. so like, well, you're basically Death Guard right now. And you're like, I know, this sucks. Yeah, it's nice to not have that be a thing. You get a little bit more of that fear of the unknown back in your opponent.
So what exactly happened that people are starting to lean into World Eaters again? Because pre-Data Slate, this army very much didn't exist. Now people are picking it up.
Just enough points reductions. Like, they didn't get like wholesale reduced, but they are cheap enough that you can justify it. You also like don't randomly lose whole 8-bound to... You don't like randomly lose a whole 8-bound squad to Devastating Wounds now. They didn't really have much choice of it themselves. Angron genuinely is just really good. And being able to like have Angron get on the board and actually live is not nothing. And also Anthony finally read what the Berserker Glaive enhancement does, and he did not realize that it was that it added D3 to your damage. And that guy on a Master Execution slaps really hard, to the point where, like, I have heard multiple stories of now of that guy one-shotting the Avatar of Cain. And, you know, like, as far as I'm concerned, that was all they were looking for. The list looks super fun. It's got a lot more pressure now. There is just a little bit less, like, it got a bit more stuff. Everyone else lost a bit of stuff. And when you're playing an army that has such binary damage thresholds and win the game thresholds as World Eaters, everything else just coming down towards the middle opens up a ton of opportunity. I think everybody said this when the rules came out. That is an oppressive rule set with garbage points values. And we're going to get to find out if it's at the point where, like, it's at least playable now, because the speed of that army is ungodly. There is nothing quite like, I think there was a quote in the stat check Discord earlier, which was like, you told me what the damage output was, and you told me what the threat range was, but I didn't understand what the damage output and the threat range was. Getting told that, yeah, I can charge 37 from this Rhino is, you know, it's a thing. And you just kind of got to be like, oh yeah, okay. Or I think it's like scout move plus turn one charge, like from like the Invocatus 8-bound squad is like 37 inches. And nobody's respecting that. How do you respect a 37-inch
when you have such ranges?
Exactly.
Pretty much.
Look, shooting is just gun shooting. Melee is just shooting with range, without range, right? That's how that works. And it's nice to see an army that has like strength profiles that feel like a 9th edition army. Like the entire 8-bound squad is like strength 12 to 14. And you're just like, wounding an Arbiter on 3s in melee with infantry just kind of feels wrong to me still, now after playing this edition for a bit. And World Eaters just are like, nah, we good. Threes is fine.
So do you think that this army still, in a way, relies on the surprise factor, or the fact that people are not that familiar with it, and the fact that the, you know, pre-data slate didn't do that army good actually helps, because now they come back twice as strong because people actually don't know what the army does?
I think it is a competitive advantage, but it is not something that you would rely on, and I think the army would be good otherwise. I think the army is, I will say, like, this is not me saying that World Eaters is the sickest army of the game. I think this guy allows a build to exist that would not exist if it didn't exist. That's why he's one of the best rules in the game. I think World Eaters are a mid-tier army that have some pretty cool rules and will punch up because people will not expect them and people will not have the respect for them. That will definitely help, but the army is just solid. I would be surprised if we didn't see like at least one World Eaters hit like at least like the Shadow Round 5-0, because the army just does exactly what it says on the tin. And yeah, people can, you can respect it, you can understand it, but unless you've really had a chance to play against it. So yeah, the surprise factor is definitely helping. But I don't think it's a bad army by any means. And I don't think if you know what it does, you know, knowing what it does just means that you get to fear it the right ways. And, you know, with an army like this, if you start respecting its threat range too much and not give it, you know, it's one of those ones where you have to give it just enough of an arm and hope it doesn't take the entire body with it. And, like, you gotta feed something to the bear, guys. Like, the bear is coming to eat something. It's either
You're going to lose something.
It's going to be your points or your limbs. You make a decision. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to just, like, feed it exactly enough stuff that it gets, like, it can't do what it wants because you're getting the right responses. And that's difficult, which, you know, if people don't have the heuristics of playing against World Eaters enough to really make use of that, yeah, I think it'll be difficult. But it'll be fine. People will be all right. They're going to lose hard to Anthony.
I think that's a great description of how to approach this army. You need to feed them those small edible chunks, but you need to be prepared that they, you know, they will bite off the entire arm. Right, let's move on to number 5. What have you brought next?
Yeah, so number 5, I have the Librarian Dreadnought, which I genuinely think is one of the most interesting data sheets they've printed. I was fairly high on it, but like before the balance data slate changes, it just kind of, it was difficult to justify running Blood Angels with all of their unique units being pointed like somebody evil wrote them, I think is probably the 43-point Sanguinary Guard. Sure, they deserve 12 points more than a Wraith Guard, right? So the Librarian Dreadnought's gimmick is that it has like a shooting profile and a damage profile that don't matter. It's toughness like 9 with a 2-up save for some random reason. So like it just doesn't die to garbage. Mm-hmm. Shooting you with an Exocrine was one of the most miserable experiences of my life. As I'm like, oh, so I wound on 5s and you save on 4s. I don't like this. So it's just like randomly tanky to other things. And then also it has this really cool ability where on a 2+, it just teleports an infantry unit at the end of the movement phase, which I don't know if anybody's noticed, but teleporting is quite strong. It's really good for getting secondaries. It's really good for applying, you know, units where you need them to be. When you're running a bunch of stuff like Death Company, being able to drop a Death Company squad down and have a 9-inch charge anywhere on the board off of the board, so you can threaten an advance and charge into a teleport into drop them somewhere. You know, one really fun thing you can do with them is like, you have your Death Company, you roll their advance when they're in Assault Doctrine, you roll like a 1 or 2 and they don't get to go anywhere. So you just leave them next to the Dreadnought and pick them up and teleport them and get a 9-inch charge somewhere else anyway, which is really cool. Like there's just like some really nice approaches to that. It's great for things like scouts. You can get like a sniper scout squad from one side of the board to the other. You can get infiltrators into a more aggressive position, you know, like playing against GSC, for example. You start with your home objective, protect them. Then by the time your opponent's sort of like drip feeding resources in the middle, you teleport them to where their blips are and start restricting them there. It's really cool and really dynamic ways to approach the game. And then there's aggressors, which kind of say, what if you just focused on these? If you've been living under a rock, you might not have noticed the aggressors plus apothecary biologist combo that's been tearing up the world since Leshu debuted it at the WTC. I say debuted, I'm sure people were playing it before, but popularized is probably the better term, which is an apothecary biologist with Bolter Discipline, giving his squad lethal hits and sustained hits, and during Devastator Doctrine, which is the turn that you get advance and charge, they also get crits on fives. Aggressors then use the Storm of Fire stratagem for +1 AP and ignore cover. They natively get +1 AP when they're shooting the closest target, and then they fire 18 plus 66 plus blast shots with a billion rerolls for most of the moment, and on average they kill Magnus.
I miss a unit like that in Death Guard.
It's called three biologist putrefiers with a playmarine squad and a rhino that all pop out and chuck grenade 4 times with Typhus to do another one to do like 15 more wounds to any unit in the game. It's quite fun.
Sounds like half of your army to do the job that aggressors do on their own. So
to be fair, it's probably not that far off the same points. The aggressor combo is 450.
Oh yeah, okay. Then yeah, then it probably is.
Yeah, because the Libby Dread costs points as well, right?
So of course.
Anyway, back to the Librarian Dreadnought. Mm-hmm. So what if you could pick that unit up and teleport it somewhere? Wouldn't that be really cool? Wouldn't that be way easier to deliver than a Land Raider that can't move on the goddamn boards? Yeah, all yours for an only 16% chance of failure every turn. So yeah, the Libby Dread does unfortunately have to roll a 2+ to use that ability. Otherwise, he just smites himself. Now, I don't know about you, but personally, I've never failed. I will never fail that ability. I just wouldn't. I would just choose not to. However, if you're playing constrained by the rules of reality, it's a fail point for the list. But what it does is do some really cool things, like have the timing of end of movement phase, which is conveniently the same time as Phantasm, which means that as the active player, you choose what order it happens. So you can either be like, I'm going to teleport and block the place you were going to Phantasm into if that was somewhere that you're going to, or I'm going to teleport into the place after you Phantasm, because I prefer to do it that way. And then they teleport, they move behind a wall, and then you teleport where you can see them anyway. It's really fun. 1 in 6 is not getting to do it, though. It's so really scary.
Yeah, so that absolutely eliminates the unit for me from the list, because with my rolls, 6 times have I used Typhus in, I think, 3 games. 5 out of 6, I rolled a 1. On his ability.
Well, so that just means that you're saving it for the invitation where you're going to roll nothing but 6s. You got to think about it. The gambler's fallacy is only a fallacy if you stop believing in it. All right.
True that. Remember, true that.
It's the gambler. It's the gambler's paradigm. If you're believing in yourself.
So brace yourself for the invitational.
I do not think the Blood Angels list exists without this guy. That's why I have him so high up. I don't think Blood Angels are the best space marines. I think Dark Angels still are, but does have a really cool option. Like, you can still do things like advance the aggressors to see if they can get into range, and if they can't, you roll like the 1, 2, 3 on the advance that you needed, then you teleport them, and you know, like that, it gives you like another fail case of hit the advance, because their advance is shooting anyway from Dev Doctrine, so teleporting them doesn't make a difference. You know, or you don't do that and you can try to hit a charge afterwards and things like that. And aggressors are not good in combat, but they do have combat attacks. It's nice to get them places. I don't know why they hit on 4s. It's very sad into Death Guard where they hit on 6s. But yeah, the Libby Dread is phenomenal fun. Just opens up really cool options. It's a nice backfield projector roll. It gives you tons of scoring options, and it allows this utterly, utterly incredible shooting unit to actually do its job, and that's great. I also want to just very quickly sidebar, what is the ordering that you have on this? It's like a snake like for the, it's like 7-6-5. Like, why is the 3 not where the 2 is, so that it's like in the right orders? I don't get it. I'm like, I don't like this.
What do you mean? Like, in...
well, like, look at the ordering. Like, it goes 6-7-5-4-3-2.
No, it goes from like the bottom. It's 7-6-5. Okay, I messed it up.
Yeah, the 3 and the 2 are the wrong way around, right? That's the, or okay, the 4 and the 5 are the wrong way around, and the 3 and the 2 are the wrong way around.
I'm correcting this. You go on. And I'm confused now. You continue, and I'm just going to make this right.
Sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to do that. Just noticed
OCD
it now,
kicking
like,
in. I understand. All
okay.
Right.
Yeah, so that's Diver and Journal. I think Bodlings are super fun. One of my teammates, Chris Irvine, is playing them for the event. He beat me yesterday with them, which was very disappointing. Turns out when you like hit every charge with Blood Angels, you win the game. Like, you would have guessed. It's a really good army for that. And stuff like Geth Company are fantastic right now. So yeah, I think Blood Angels are poised to do fairly well at the event. I look forward to seeing what other people come up with, but they look super fun. They're a genuinely really cool army right now.
Yeah, I'm actually paired up in Coppenhammer to play against Blood Angels right now. So, and I can't remember if the Libby Dreadnought is there. I think he is. So it's good that we've just done this episode, so I will know what to expect. Fantastic.
Expect already the Libby Dreadnought to never fail to teleport. Now, I will say one thing. I do wish it had, like, you know how a bunch of the psychic powers have, like, on a 2+ do a thing, on a 6 do an extra cool thing? The Libby Dreadnought doesn't have that. He's just on a 2+, and then on 1 you spite yourself. I feel like on a 6 you should get to coming, like, 6 away instead of 9 away. But I feel like maybe... Yeah. It's just the scam potential. Could you imagine losing a final so your opponent rolling a 6 on that, and their aggressor is just like being in your deployment zone instead because you screen them out 9 but not 6? That'd be great. I think that would be the best story. Gives you a courage for not printing that.
I am actually now my mind is bent because with those numbers that you pointed out, I have like separate slides for everything, and I'm now hyper focused on how to make it right so that on the next slides it doesn't happen again. I'm just gonna drop it. I'm just gonna correct it at the
just
end.
Just leave it. It's fine. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It just I just wanted to point it out because otherwise I was gonna forget.
I'll correct
forget
it.
To be a little bit upset about it.
I'll correct it at the very end. Cool. Let's move on to your number 4, no matter where the 4 is.
Sure. This is the new Tyranid Neurolictor, which is phenomenal. So for anybody who's not playing against the Neurolictor, it is a 60 to 75 point lone op that has a 4+ invulnerable save, is 7 wounds with toughness 5, is has a 12-inch ability to pick a unit and it just takes a battle shock test in your command phase, and then also kicks out an incredible aura of anything within 12 of it that is battle shock is -1 to hit and you are +1 to wound against it. Just a phenomenal little force multiplier. It does everything you're looking to do. Forces Battleshocks in turn. It's an army that really, really, really likes your opponent to be Battleshocked because they don't have a ton of damage output, and you know, restricting your opponent's objective control that way is much easier way to do it. It has Shadow in the Warp. It has a bunch of stratagems and abilities. So Synaptic Nexus has a stratagem that whenever your opponent feels Battleshock within 12 of you, you can make them take mortal wounds on a 3+ for 6 dice. You have Vanguard Invasion that can get +1 to wound against Battleshock units in melee. You have the Neuro Tyrant that gets +1 to wound against Battleshock units if it's leading a unit like Neurogods, which it does in something like Synaptic, which it does in something like the Swarm List. There's just a ton of ways to really abuse your opponent being Battleshocked. And also, as a low damage output army, +1 to wound against Battleshock units is really good. And Tyranids can, like, I think I ran the numbers of getting up. You can get up to like 18 Battleshocks in a turn against a unit if you really want to. I don't recommend it. It requires running like horror specs and stuff. But the fact that you can do that is quite funny. And you start hitting the point where it actually becomes a reliable mechanic. And Neurolictors were just kind of like the last bit of cream on top of that to really make that an actual viable playstyle. Because the ability to make a unit take a Battleshock doesn't require line of sight, you can kind of sit behind a wall, wholly within 12 of an objective, so that any unit on it, you can make it take a Battleshock. So on the LGT boards, with that very open middle, but often a Ruin Bearer nearby, you put a Neurolictor into there, and your opponent ever tries to take that middle, you can Battleshock them. You put them on the side objectives that are alone up, they sit on the objective, and anything tries to take it off it, you Battleshock it before you do your scoring. So if you put an opponent as a unit on it, overmatches your OC, and you're like, cool, take a Battleshock, and they fail it, cool, that's 5 primary back without you actually having to interact. And there's just night, just flows really well. They do everything you're looking for. Now, what they don't do is any effing damage, but who cares? They're like they're cheap loan ops. Like, it's unreasonable to expect them to also be good in combat, and they're not bad. Like, they'll fight cultists to death, and that's honestly, you know, like, if a, like a guardsman squad runs at them, like, they might kill the guard squad, and that's really all I'm looking for out of my 60 to 70 point models. Mm-hmm. Remember, Terra players, don't gaslight yourself. Just because Death Leaper's big now does not mean he's good in combat.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it was, it might have been Dom Madlow on the 6++ podcast who said that he loves taking action monkeys that can deal with the opponent's action monkeys. And I think this is one of them.
Like, yeah, I mean, like, it's not going to win a fight against, like, anything with two wounds, because it's six attacks and 6-2-1. But anything, like, literal garbage, it'll take it on. And for me, that's all I'm really looking for.
Yeah. So you've mentioned this already, but it does look, especially with the Tyranids book, that GW is really putting an effort into making Battleshock something that counts, something that may alter the way the game goes. But have you actually seen, I mean, I know you are a Tyranid player yourself, so have you actually seen that happen? Have you actually experienced Battleshock? Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, God, yeah. Battleshock is, like, nuts now. Like, Battleshock is an impactful mechanic. I have played 5 or 6 games with the Terra Codex, and every single one, Battleshock has been a very meaningful impact on the game, whether that's from the army-wide Shadow in the Warp, with Neural Tyrant, everything to take a test of -1. There are a bunch of, like, leadership 7 armies in the game right now, and, like, on average, half of that army Battleshocks. Like, that is...
Yeah.
You know, like, Tau, army-wide, leadership 6 and 7, guided Tau units, when they are Battleshocked, cannot spot for other units. So, like, you Battleshock a couple of Tetra squads, and suddenly you don't take damage that turn. You can't do signals, you can't do behind me, you can't do cleanse, you can't do engage on all fronts. There are a lot of ways that gets punished. Now, there are some armies that care about it less. You know, if you're universally a leadership 5 or 6 army, you know, if you're playing, like, Primarchs or Chaplains, or you're all in transports where you don't take Battleshocks, like, yeah, there are armies that mitigate it, but even there, you still, like, you know, your backfield objective holder might just turn off and you have to send something back and you just take less damage that turn. Then you have all the ways that you, like, actually, like, capitalize on it during the turn. So Synaptic Nexus, the stratagem for better grenades when your opponent fails a Battleshock, you chuck that out almost every turn if you get the opportunity. Your opponent's taking 4 or 5 Battleshocks. The odds they don't fail any of them is incredibly low. It's not reliable, but it's not reliable on single units. It's reliable on mass. It's very difficult to kind of describe the mechanic, but what it kind of ends up being is, it's kind of like tactical cards, where they're not a thing that you plan for. They're a thing you kind of adjust your game plan on the fly for. Battleshock kind of feels the same way from Tyranids. You're going to make a bunch of units take Battleshocks, and then you're going to look at the game state after your command phase of the turn that you did Shadow in the Warp, or after the turn that you did all your Neuralictors and all your strategies. You're going to say, based on the new information of what is now Battleshock, can I ignore something, or can I focus on something I didn't otherwise get to? You know, if that unit of Swooping Hawks in your backfield suddenly doesn't score any points for your opponent this turn or next turn, probably don't need to overwatch them, so you can spend your overwatch somewhere else on something that was a little less optimal, a little more of a high roll, but now gives you, like, opportunities. And that's kind of what you're looking for out of it. Yeah, it's not reliable on the single unit, because you can't ever, you know, any unit on average, if they're leadership 6, they take a test on the 7, they're going to pass it 44% of the time, or they're going to pass it 56% of the time, which means they're failing for it. It means you cannot count on it on any individual unit, but some units are going to fail. And that just allows you to change your game plan for it. Neuralictors just feed into that a little more. That aura of -1 to hit, +1 to wound is phenomenal. But the number of times I've played against, like, a Tower Votan army, and it's like, hey, everything takes a Shadow in the Warp. Also, everything that's next to Death Leaper takes a Battleshock as well, because it's below starting strength. So, like, 5-4 of your units are taking 2 Battleshock tests, and then, like, the Neuralictor set another 1 or 2, and then everything in your army is taking, like, at least 1. And then at the end of that turn, they have, like, 3 units that are Battleshock. And you're like, cool, those ones get shot down, or those ones are in your backfield, or the Trigon charges those ones. And now, they're not scoring primary, and they're not denying you primary, and you have, like, 1 dude on an objective that's controlling it against, like, 4 units, because he's the only thing on it with objective control. There is nothing wrong with Battleshock now, especially with the mechanic of, like, you having to spend the CP beforehand. You cannot auto-pass at all the Shadow Lord Battleshock. You can't auto-pass the Neuralictor Battleshock. You can't auto-pass the Stratagem Battleshock from Vanguard Invasion. Like, all of these are just, they happen or they don't. There's nothing your opponent can do about it. And then they're going to spend a CP once per game on passing 1 Battleshock? Like, fine, whatever.
Does any of the armies that actually have returning units do that, like, I don't know, Necrons, GSC, or maybe Guard, does any of them pay CP to do that?
Oh, for if you don't spend that CP on like an like there is a very real world, like if your Necron Warrior brick gets battle shocked, it dies. So
yeah, because it cannot return, right? Because
You get the chip damage at that point. It gets one return off a random off a ghost arc if it's got one, and that's it. And I can kill one Necron Warrior brick if it doesn't have an additional 40 models in it.
Yeah.
Especially if I just want to wound it.
So it grows in value even more.
Yeah. Spend your CP, but you can't if I battle shot you off of
what I was going for. That's amazing.
Yeah, no, I love the Neuralictor. It's by far the most interesting new unit that came out of Tyranids. It opened up a ton of playstyles. I know there's been a bunch of hype about Tyranids in terms of like the new detachments like Vanguard Onslaught and Synaptic Nexus. Invasion Fleet loves the plus one to wound because the amount of damage, like the army whites exploding sixes against infantry units for sustained hits one. Is turbocharged by plus one wound because that's one of the biggest that's with the armies that doesn't really have a ton of spike damage. Being able to just have all of that be an additional plus one to wound, suddenly you're actually wounding vehicles on force. Armbreakers are leadership 7, right? Like you make two armbreakers take a test, one of them is on average failing. If you make them all take a test at -1, on average an armbreaker fails. So you know, like Chaos Knight suddenly becomes a matchup that you know you have options in. Be careful with the demons, they heal off of battle shocks if you're not careful. But other than that, go nuts.
Yeah, and you know, maybe last question and we will move on to the next one. But it might be a loaded question. How would you assess Tyranids right now? Because right after the WTC, I played a test game versus Pumbaa. That was before the Codex, and I had a fairly solid build. He said even that, you know, it was a nice build, but it's very high skill count, so you need to have a lot of reps into it to actually know how it plays and so on. I didn't have the time to play that, so I didn't take any of that to the Invitational. But would you agree that Tyranids right now is a fairly high skill cap army to get into because of all those tricks and you know stuff that you need to do, the setup that you need to create for your army actually to do damage? Because
I think you can get by pretty well with Tyranids without having like a really good like as long as you have like a basic game plan of, you know, how do you approach playing fixed secondaries and get the most out of them? How do you position like the key models like the Hive Tyrant and things like that? Like, how do you get the most out of them? Like, there's definitely a you must be this tall to ride. Like, you've got to get a certain amount of like weight into the army, and then there's a lot. But then like once you hit that level, like you can get a lot more out of them, but you don't really have to. You can definitely just like rely on very reasonably priced monster data sheets and good scoring options and just get your points. And that's great in like a team environment where you're just trying to like, you know, you'll get like your 7 to 10 points in almost every game. When you try to apply that to like a singles environment, you're probably going to have a rougher time. I think it's a really cool army. I think the new detachments have cleaned that up a little bit. There's a few more simple options. Like Invasion Fleet has this very real, like I said, this really very real damage problem where Synaptic Nexus cleans that up a little bit. It gives you the reroll ones to hit and wound stratagem. You can run Zone Thropes a little more efficiently. Vanguard Onslaught gives you the binary, if I go first, I will win. If I go second, we'll see what happens ability. You know, so there's a little bit less impetus on exactly playing the control style or the horde style especially. But no, I don't think they're kind of landing somewhere around like that 5 to 8 army spot where like you're never going to be happy to pair into them, but you're like, oh, I'm glad this isn't Eldar, I'm glad this isn't CSM kind of thing for me, where like I feel like as long as I play well, I'm not going to just like randomly lose to Tyranids because they did something. I will be playing a game the entire way through, and that's fine. That's kind of where you want armies to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think Tyranids are really cool. That's partly why I'm not taking them to LGT. Partly is that, and partly is just I did not really feel like painting all of the Tyranid army because it's a ton of organics, and oh my god. So I've got like an RTT a couple weeks after LGT that I should have some painting time for, and I'm hoping to take them to that, and we'll see where I land for them for like World Championships and things like that. But yeah, it's an interesting place to be.
Okay, very good. And I share the sentiment about painting all those models. My pile of shame is so big when it comes to Tyranids.
I try not to think about it.
Yeah.
Plus, mine is the Nord is gorgeous, and I do not want a rush job and ruin it. So
I'm gonna have someone paint it for me. I don't believe I have the skills, even though I like to paint my armies dirty. That's why Death Guard. That's why Tyranids. I just wouldn't like a centerpiece model like that to be painted by me. That would be a huge waste. Anyway. Number 3 on your list, what would that be?
Okay, this is one that's probably not surprising anyone. It might surprise people on where it is, which is Abaddon. Abaddon is a ton of things to a ton of different armies. He's Dark Pact rerolls in an aura, he has hit rerolls in an aura, and he's 4+ invulnerable in an aura. And all of those kind of do their own very reasonable thing. The simplest one that people have probably seen before is the hit rerolls aura, which you just kind of, you either run it with Terminators, you run it with guns, you run it with Obliterators and Forge Fiends, and you just have a turbocharged shooting castle. For 310 points, I think I'm starting to struggle with him on that one. But if you want to play that style, Abaddon is the way you make it sing. He makes Nurgle demon engines incredibly powerful. Like, full rerolls on them is amazing when you have sustained hits on fives. Just does a ton of stuff. He's a good ingress threat. He works very well with Terminators as a damage output source. Does a lot of stuff. The other version is the 4+ vulnerable save bubble, which is mostly run with cultists. And that's the list we were talking about a little bit earlier when we were talking about the invitational list for Matt that Manny is running, which is like a ton of accursed cultists and regular cultists with a 4+ vulnerable save, which just says, this is hard to kill. And it turns out things that are hard to kill are good at scoring. I don't know if anybody's noticed that before, but when a unit's on an objective and you can't kill it, it usually stays on that objective.
With a crazy OC number.
Yeah, exactly. And Abaddon is pretty solid for just doing that. The reason he's kind of down in like three is that I don't think Abaddon Abaddon definitely makes builds exist that wouldn't otherwise, but I don't think he's like the best unit. Like, I don't, there are definitely CSM builds that can play him and don't need him. Where I like the rest of these, I kind of think if you're playing this army, you probably need this. Whereas Abaddon, for the builds he makes exist, he's great, but there are CSM builds that exist without him, which I think kind of changes him in the way that I think about force multipliers. So he's kind of here, but hedged. I think in the best builds that he plays in, he's the best unit in the army. But you don't have to have him, so I have him a little bit lower down. But Abaddon is phenomenal. He does a ton of stuff. He is an absolute monopolist of that Nurgle stratagem, because if he gets shot, your game plan falls apart completely. And that's fine. Like, it's okay. You're allowed to have a unit that if it dies, it's going to suck, as long as you're willing to spend the effort to keep it alive. But it does eat your Nurgle stratagem. The can't shoot me. Now you can't use it on other things, and that has a real cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to be perfectly honest, when we first discussed the topic that we were going to talk about, I was sure Abaddon would end up in position number one. My experience playing CSM so far, I played like three or four games into them. Abaddon was in every single list. He is a nightmare. He is an absolute, I mean, when it comes to force multiplication and like the amount of shots that CSM are able to pull thanks to him, it's hideous. It's disgusting. It's like, when I see all the units that CSM can bring and all the shots and hits that they bring to the table thanks to him, it's he is an actual number one. But I'm sure you have your justification for your number two and number one. So maybe without further ado, let's just see what those are.
Sure. So number two, I have the Tetra, which is the Tau unit that has two really cool rules. One is it gives out, it has the marker light keyword, which means that when it guides a unit or when it spots for a unit, giving them the +1/+1 skill, it also provides ignore cover. And then also it gives them chapter master rerolls, which I don't know if you know, is a really good rule. Given that we were just talking about Abaddon, it turns out that Tau units that normally hit on fours, when they hit on threes, rolling with exploding sixes and double exploding sixes when they're being guided, they kill everything. There is just, the Tau army doesn't exist without Tetras. You cannot play Tau without Tetras. They score, they infiltrate, they are weirdly resilient. They are toughness 7 with 7 wounds and a 4+ save for 40 points a model. Like, I think they might have one of the best point per wound like in the game. They don't do anything. Like, they don't have any guns or anything, but they don't need to. They can just sit and score and say, hey, you get ignore cover for rerolls. And when you're shooting like 66 cyclic ion blaster shots, it kills everything. They allow just so much of the Tau army to actually function. They infiltrate to stop people getting on top of you as quickly. They are movement 14 or something stupid like that, so they score well. They're just nothing. They're very little they don't do for the point value. And I think if you're not running at least two squads in the Tau army, you're probably trolling. And I would honestly probably run three. They just are good scoring units. Their gun isn't nothing. It's just like a couple of like the pulse blasters. They can tank shock. I don't recommend it. They're like strength 3. But still an option. You got to get a mortal wound on something. There's worse ways to do it. I think Tau are an incredibly strong army coming into LGT. I would not be surprised to see multiple in the top cut. And I think Tetras are the reason they can do that. Everything else is great in Tau. Ghost skills are phenomenal scoring units. Crisis suits are fast. They hit really hard. And without Tetras, it does not matter because they do no damage, because they do not hit.
So yeah, I'm not going to be very original. I'm not going to be very original with the question, but I'll repeat the question that I asked when we were talking about the reanimator. If you faced out on the table and you see Tetras, is it a unit that you should prioritize to get rid of in order to, somehow cripple the output of the entire army? Or again, do we focus on the hammers and get rid of them because models that are dead do not score, do not
So this
kill
is a
you, etc.?
really weird question, because there's kind of two answers. If you can kill them, it's great to kill the Tetras. But if you just probably kill them, it's almost not worth it. Because if you leave one Tetra on one wound, you have done nothing to that squad. Which means you've got to do 14. The first 13 damage you do to the squad do not matter, other than in the context that it will make it easier to kill it later. And if you leave one on one wound, that unit does not need to take a battleship test because it is still one of two models and not below starting strength, so it'll still be able to guide. And it
And it still
sits on an
doesn't score,
objective
yeah.
and it has an OC and it still guides and it still has a marker light. It still goes to a corner and does signals and blah blah blah. So if you can kill it, great. If you can't, just kill one crisis suit instead. Just put some damage on a ghost kill, hurt a broadside, because that will do more for you. Tau are a very weird army in that all of their units that do damage are, besides broadsides, universally pretty fast and pretty good at scoring and pretty decent OC. Which means that once those, if you kill the Tetras, it maybe makes them play more aggressive with the Crisis Suits, but it doesn't stop them scoring in the same way that killing like all the things around your Necron Warrior Brick that can't get to an objective otherwise does. Because that Tau squad can go 18 and then shoot and then move another 12. It's hard to just like stop a Tau army scoring if a Tau army wants to score. So it's difficult to say, like, yeah, just kill the scoring elements because their scoring elements are their killing units. So if you know you can kill the Tetras are easier to kill. But you better make damn sure you kill them, otherwise you've done nothing. That's kind of my process on it. Which usually to me means just go for the Crisis Suits, because a Crisis Suit squad that's guided by like a ghost keel, it still hurts. Like, it's gonna hit on threes, no rerolls, it's still double exploding sixes though. Like, you still don't want that. And would you rather kill one Crisis Suit and get shot by like five of the rerolls? Probably not. But if you're not going to kill the Tetras anyway, you're getting shot by six with the rerolls. So you might as well make it more consistent. So no, I don't have a good answer for you. It's always going to be contextual on what you're damaging them with and how you're approaching killing them and how reliable it is that you can kill them. If they're just like, a lot of the time they're just like sat on a cover base, which gives, it's one of those weird things where if you got a 4-up save, you're a lot better at using cover than a 3-up save unit is, because you actually get it against AP zero. And Tetras are good resilience against that sort of thing. So
Yeah, there is no good answer.
yeah.
All right, then, if you want to know more about how to tackle Tau or how to play Tau, we did an episode with Kyle Grundy, who is like a Tau connoisseur, and he plays Tau exclusively. So we did an episode with him on his top seven strongest Tau data sheets or something like that, and how to tackle them. A very almost like a master class sort of episode where you can learn a lot about Tau and both how to pilot it and play against it. And he also talks about Tetras and their role and how to go about them when you play against. So do check out that episode and all the other episodes from the series, because all of them provide a lot of insight. So they're out there in the Contact Lost YouTube channel or on Spotify. Right, I think the time has come for your number one.
I'll do my honorable mention first,
All
because
right,
I
that's good.
so my honorable mention, which is one that I don't think is technically a force multiplier, but it definitely feels like a force multiplier, is the effing Yinkarn. It's a force multiplier in the sense that it multiplies the literal force that I want to apply to my head to a desk, because I just want to smack. No, the Yinkarn. The way I try to think about the Yinkarn is it's an additional effect that comes attached to Nightspinner damage output. It's like once you kill something, it explodes into a Yinkarn, and that you increase the damage output of the Nightspinner that way.
Interesting way to put it, but yeah, very much so. Yeah,
It's like,
undeniably.
the Nightspinner is like a Pokemon trainer. It throws out a Pokeball with the Yinkarn, and it says, "Hey, go smash somebody," and then it does, and then you're sad. Yeah, the Yinkarn makes everything else in the Elder Army become impossible to deal with, which is for my definition of force multiplier. You can't kill a Swooping Hawk squad because now the Yinkarn is there. You can't, lose a squad because now the Yinkarn is there. You can't have your units next to each other because now the Yinkarn is there. And that gives the Eldar list a ton of space to work with. It causes you problems. It makes you think about different things. You have to consider every opportunity, and they only have to pick the best one or the one that you didn't account for the worst. It makes Phantasm and Fire and Fade and Indirect and Overwatch and every single one of these things just the worst to deal with. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's a force multiplier, because all it says is every single thing you do, you have to double think because of the Incarn. And there is nothing you can do to like make it not good.
It surely is a hatred multiplier.
Oh, it's definitely that. I definitely hate the Incarn the most.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think it's underpriced? Or would it be okay if it...
The Incarn would be good at 700 points, so yeah.
Mm. All right. How about if they did the, you know, change the charging bit to the way it was before? So, like...
If they just made it not a unit, that would probably be best.
That's fair as well. But, yeah. So, do you have any other honorable mentions?
I don't really think about bad armies. That's the problem. Golemon and the Lion are extant. Golemon is not good. Neither is the Lion, but they both do stuff for buffing your army. I think things like Creed have definitely fallen off because there's just not as much regiment stuff in Guard that really benefits from it. Bellicor, I guess, is worth mentioning. Mm-hmm. I think Bellicor makes the Demon's Army work, but the Demon's Army is not good, where therefore he's not worth shouting out.
All right. It hurts my soul that you didn't mention Mortarion, because he is... I mean, the first time I heard the term force multiplier in 10th edition was about Mortarion. And
he is a force multiplier. Mortarion is very good, but Mortarion is like... The nicest thing I could say about Mortarion is that he's really cheap.
Yes. Definitely. Well, his aura is really nice as well.
Mortarion's really good. I just don't think he makes Death Guard Death Guard strong enough for his inclusion to be worth justifying in, like... I think Death Guard are fine, and I think Mortarion is a good unit in Death Guard, but I don't think that Mortarion, like, if you're not next to Mortarion, you're like, you feel it a bit, but it's not like problematic. You can still make stuff happen when you're not near him. If you're running a triple Piper's Collar, sure, like, I get it. But, you know, not everybody's playing that. You know, especially not everybody's playing Entropy Cannons, that kind of thing. Mortarion is good. Mortarion is a very, very good Deishi. Every single one of these is better. Mortarion is 320 points, man. He is so cheap. But he does not...
He doesn't do anything else. Like, he doesn't... He's not the beatstick he used to be.
He doesn't kill an Armiger on average. That's the depress. He is the 1 in 3 to kill a single Imperial Armiger in combat with a 6 of Field of Pain. 30%. Mm-hmm. That's depressing.
Yeah, but you still try to protect...
100% in every army.
But, you know, what I wanted to say is that sometimes he works like... I don't know the expression. But like a stopper, I guess. Because you want to keep him in the back because you're afraid he's going to die and you don't want to lose your 320 points. But if you do keep him in the back, then it's a waste of 320 points.
Yeah, Mortarion's a distraction card effect.
Yeah, pretty much.
Mortarion exists, like, Mortarion is a force multiplier, but you do not take him because he is a force multiplier. You take him because he does reasonable combat, has a good aura, is good at distracting, is very tanky, right? That's like, you take him for a bunch of things. He happens to, as part of that, be a force multiplier. It is not his primary role. I think Abaddon is the closest to like that not being his primary role, and the Incarn, obviously, which is why the Incarn's not actually on this list. Abaddon is kind of the closest to that, but I think Abaddon does his job more of that side of things than Mortarion does.
Yeah.
You're generally pretty happy in a game where like Abaddon never got into combat. Sometimes the same thing happens, where like the happiest thing you can say is he took a whole turn to die, so all my other stuff got into combat, and like that's fine too. But it's, you know, less his role. Mortarion definitely wants to be in combat more because he just is less of his power budget is invested into making your other stuff better. He is generally, in technicality, a tanky beatstick. And that would, you know, if we were doing a top 7 tanky beat sticks, he wouldn't be on that list either, but, you know.
But he's there, so.
He'd be in the honorable mentions for that one.
Yeah. He's the best of the bad choices. Anyway, let's move on to your number one then.
Sure. So my number one is the Autarch Wayleaver, because, oh my fucking god, I hate this model. What if it just did everything? And there was just everything. What if you got an extra CP for one of the cheapest sources of extra CP in the game on a 14-inch moving load operative with an assault weapon, the grenade keyword, and fight first? That also just like auto advances six off of fake dice and has a melta gun.
And he's infantry, so he can phantasm.
Yeah. And he has fire and fade access. Obviously, Eldar don't have to shoot to fire and fade like Tau do. So don't worry about that.
It should just go be fade, basically.
Yeah. Whoever wrote that rule is gonna get faded. Like that. The Altar Wheelieper takes everything Eldar needs, every single thing, and says, "What if it was all just one model?" And then you're like, "I'm gonna take that model." And then you're like, "Yeah, I know you are. No fucking shit."
And yeah, I mean, even the CP region, which happens just because you have him in your army. It's not that you have to roll something. Not even a freaking two up. It's
just
doesn't
have to be on the goddamn board. He will be because he's a load up. But
how after that insult to injury,
and Asriel has to be on the board, and the Wheelieper has to like be waving at you from his castle. You could strip like four of the eight things that this data sheet does off of it, and it would still be one of the best data sheets in the game
and worth its points.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It'd be worth it at twice the. It wouldn't be worth it at twice the points. That's an exaggeration. But this guy is undercosted. He does too much. He's the kind of the model you can't point this guy appropriately. He just does too much. Like the second you make this guy appropriately pointed, he is like a 170 point unit, and you're not going to pay that for an infantry model, which means that they can't balance it. You just have to take some rules off it. Yeah, which you just shouldn't give this much stuff to an infantry douche, right? That's kind of the peel and end all. This guy just cleans up the other game button. You want to play fixed or tactical? Doesn't matter. Like you're thinking about the CP? No, just pick whichever one's best for the game, Eldar. Don't worry about like having to have trade-offs, like playing a more guaranteed game plan in order to lose, like, but you lose the CP. No, you have the CP anyway, so don't worry about it. Don't just play tactical if it's better, play fixed if it's better. Like just think about the game state. Everybody else, like stick with tactical because you need the CP. Eldar, you do whatever you want. You're God's most precious child.
I can feel the hatred for the model so much. But is it for the model or is it for the faction?
Can it be both?
Yeah, why not both? Sure. Is there a way you think that this army can be balanced, or does it need like a fundamental rewrite?
I don't care. I just don't care. I don't want it to be balanced anymore, but I also respect that that's not really like the right thing to say. I want Eldar to just stop existing. I don't want Eldar to be a thing that I have to play against the tournaments. I don't want their rule set to be something I have to think about. But I also respect that's because, well, I came up in 7th edition where they were this but worse. So it's hard to like be objective on this. I have never had a positive opinion on Eldar, and I understand that the army can't just not exist in the game, and that it probably can't just have like a 4% win rate as much as I would love it to. But I don't want to stop thinking about it at a tournament. Mm.
So tell me this, for your coaching service that you do, have you ever had a person playing Eldar come to you?
Oh yeah, I have like four or five Eldar clients all the time, and I work with them exactly the same as I would anybody else, because this is my public persona, Tomek. This is the person I am on content, not the person I am in my professional environment.
Right,
and I need to understand those are separate things, and if you are an Eldar player that's looking for help, do hit me up. I'm more than happy to help. I even, for example, would play Eldar into a coaching client if they asked me to, because it's my job. My job is to help somebody the best I can, and I'm not going to let my personal perspective. Like, if they ask me what my opinion on Eldar is, I'm not going to be nice about it. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to tell them that I'm not going to help them. Like, it's kind of a terrible business decision.
Yeah.
This is ultimately, this is a persona, guys. You need to remember that.
So what do you think, judging by the event results after the data slate and so on, do you think it's going to be Eldar that take the top at the LGT?
Yeah, I would be shocked if Eldar weren't 1, 2, and 3 again.
Mm-hmm.
I would expect Eldar to be 50% of the top cut.
Wow. Okay.
They won't be, but I would expect it to be. Mm-hmm. There is no way over an event this long that there aren't some other players who get upset, some other players who mirror match. But like, if you ask me if like I thought Vic, Brian, Dan Whitaker, and like somebody Nass. Else, like and Nass, yeah, would be like four of the top eight. Yeah, 100%. I would 100% bet on that. Mm-hmm. I think you'd be stupid not to.
And what would be your personal favorite to take it? Like, what
Oh,
would you,
any
what
well,
would
I
make
mean,
you
I've got
happy?
a anyone but Ignite, right? So
No, I was
that's like,
thinking faction, not teams.
oh, I don't care about factions. I just don't want one of Ign I just don't want anyone for Ignite to win.
Fair enough.
I don't want Ignite or Mani or Nassim. And anyone from Ignite or Team England, especially if you're both Vic.
Personal grudges.
Yeah, I would love Sako to get the repeats with CSM. I got to
Yeah, that
CSM
would
because
be
I'm
sweet.
playing them, right? Sako or Liam getting it, I would obviously love to.
See that
Yeah,
happen,
but I think CSM or Nid, I would be really cool if Nids won as well. And I'll really
yeah.
regret not playing them if Nids win, but I also just could not find a list that I liked well enough. Watching triple Norn Emissary at Chariot Hammer get like lose double Norn Emissary turn one to Eldar was like yeah, so put that back in the box.
Gut-wrenching, yeah.
Like maybe the toughest 11 model with a 2-up save isn't great into fire prisms.
So it seems. Right. Okay. Ines, I think we are done with the list. So I thank you for it. I thank you for coming prepared because this is something that I've seen throughout this entire series. I'm actually shocked and surprised how prepared people come to this. So thank you for playing
Well, I'm
along
glad
as
I
well.
tricked you into thinking I was prepared.
Well, you definitely made an impression. Sending the list to me a day in advance already shows that you've put some thought process into it, which I am very grateful for. Is there anything that you would like to plug before we
Yeah,
finish the
I'll plug
episode?
the normals. I'm gonna be at LGT. If you're there, come and say hi. I would always love to. I'm pretty sure like Anthony's brought over a bunch of stat check dice, so we'll have some of those to hand out as well. With that then ties into I'm part of stat check, so that's stat-check.com or youtube.com/statcheck. We do a live show every Thursday, every Tuesday, apologies, at 11 p.m. GMT or various other times across the globe that I do not care to know. And that's where you can catch me and Jeremy and Nathan and Anthony and a bunch of other people, guests and all that, having our opinions on 4K, running through the stats of the week and all that sort of thing. It's a great show. We really do enjoy doing it. That goes up live on all the podcast feeds and on YouTube, usually the day after. You can also check out stat-check.com/coaching if you're interested in hearing more from me on working on anything, whether you want to get better at the game, you want to just dive into a tournament, you want to do some reviews, anything like that. Always happy to help out. It's been awesome. Contact Lost is definitely the my job in 40K one definitely drove a few people towards me, so I have to buy you a drink at LGT for that one. But no, it's been great. It's really appreciated. So yeah, if that's something that interests you, please do check that out. We're coming up to stuff like Atlanta and Coventry and Cali Cup and all that sort of thing. So if you're doing any of those or you're trying to qualify for your national team, now's a great time. So come check it out. It would be wonderful.
Thank you for that. Is LGT going to be the topic for the next episode tomorrow, or
I
are you
think
focusing on something
so.
else?
Anthony's not on the show because he's in Scotland right now at Brian's, so probably, but I'm not 100% sure. It should be, but
We'll see.
we're having Nathan's having a little bit of a tough time at work at the moment in terms of like bit workload, so we have no idea who's going to be on the show right now. So we will find out what the show is going to be about tomorrow at 11 when everybody else does.
That's understandable. I mean, this week is going to be hectic for everyone, so I'm not surprised.
Yeah, I leave on Wednesday for LGT, so I leave on Wednesday night.
Yeah, I leave on Thursday, so I know the pain. Anyway, to all our listeners, this is not the only episode that we are going to be releasing today. In the evening today, we're going to do a live session with John Swallow, and we're going to talk about preparing for the event. So, like in general, preparing for major events and how to do that. So, a topic that we covered with Ines last year. So, you might want to check that one out
Yeah,
while you
don't
wait.
listen to that advice from last year. I did garbage last year. So
But the advice was actually quite sound, and I like the thing that you mentioned about like bringing a mat to put under your feet. I've seen and heard many people mention that they've learned that from you, and they do it the same. I mean, they do the same
there was
thing now.
tons of people with them at WATC. I was very
Yeah,
jealous because I
exactly.
didn't think I did. I forgot to do it and didn't have
Exactly.
one.
I think that was your impact on the hobby that you convinced people that it's a good
I've
idea.
got one thing going for me. Some advice I stole from Brian. Yep.
But it's very good. And then tomorrow, probably Joker will be, and Ines, I will need your help on the pronunciation of the name because I never know whether it's French or English. But Joker will be interviewing Clem or
Think it's Clément.
Clement Tourmonde or something like that.
Definitely can't pronounce that surname. Sorry.
Yeah, so I was hoping to have a discussion with the gentleman before the show to find out how to pronounce it. But actually, it's going to be Joker who's going to be doing the interview. And if we can squeeze one more, then perhaps on Wednesday we will do an interview with Josh Roberts that we wanted to do last week, but due to like clash of time and so on, we couldn't. So maybe we will manage to squeeze in one more. So 3 to 4 episodes coming out this week before the ALGT. So watch this space. Click the subscribe button, the alert button, or the bell button on YouTube and so on. And check Spotify frequently because, yeah, there is a lot coming from us. So thank you for sticking with us. Thank you for watching. Thank you, Ines, for joining me. As always, it's been great pleasure.
Like,
And
comment,
I'll.
and subscribe. Get down there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Also, do consider being a patron. I mentioned this in every episode. The link to the patron page will be down below in the description as well. And I think it's enough of announcements. Ines, I'll see you at the event, and it's been great fun talking
Yeah,
to
see you
you.
on Friday. See you around one.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed. All right. You have a good one. Bye, everyone.